All right, as I mentioned last week, today is, Lord willing, the last in our study in Deuteronomy for a while. We're going to take a break and look at worship practice next week. And this is a sort of a logical break in the book of Deuteronomy. There are a couple of points left over from last week. You may remember in Deuteronomy 25 we had a fairly extensive discussion about what might be called fine points. And there are a couple of fine points I wanted to clarify. First, we talked about different weights and different measures and the practice that people had of, merchants had of stealing basically by adjusting the weights they used for buying versus the weights for selling. And I realized later that my explanation was maybe confused or confusing because it depends on whether what you're weighing out is the produce, like if someone brings in something to sell you so you can sell it in your market. It depends on whether the buyer weighs out the produce or weighs out the money that they're going to pay the person for the produce. We don't think of weighing out money, but they didn't have standardized, you know, nickels and dimes and so on. And so it depends on which of those you're weighing out, whether you want heavier weights or lighter weights to cheat the person. And obviously, I don't have a lot of experience in the matter, but I didn't make that part very clear. And the other, so this is really specialized, we had a discussion in connection with the law of the levirate about the marriage of a man to his deceased brother's wife. And in the midst of that, I was explaining the sort of traditional understanding that that was a violation of the law in Leviticus. That was incest, but there was an exception made in this case. And I should have mentioned at the time that the our Reformed Presbyterian testimony says specifically the prohibition of marriage with a deceased wife's sister or a deceased husband's brother is not warranted by Scripture. And they cite Leviticus 18 and Deuteronomy 25 in connection with that. Okay, I'm sure there are lots of other confusing points left over, and I may have just confused you more, but I thought I should mention those two. Okay, so today, as I said, we're coming to the last chapter in this long section in Deuteronomy, this long middle section about the law. And I think you'll see that it's a really fitting and helpful conclusion to the section we've been looking at. So I'll read Deuteronomy 26. And it shall be when you come into the land which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, and you possess it and dwell in it, that you shall take some of the first of all the produce of the ground which you shall bring from your land that the Lord your God is giving you, and put it in a basket, and go to the place where the Lord your God chooses to make his name abide. And you shall go to the one who is priest in those days, and say to him, I declare today to the Lord your God that I have come to the country which the Lord swore to our fathers to give us. Then the priest shall take the basket out of your hand and set it down before the altar of the Lord your God. And you shall answer and say before the Lord your God, my father was a Syrian about to perish, and he went down to Egypt and dwelt there, few in number. And there he became a nation, great, mighty, and populous. But the Egyptians mistreated us, afflicted us, and laid hard bondage on us. Then we cried out to the Lord God of our fathers, and the Lord heard our voice and looked on our affliction and our labor and our oppression. So the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand and with an outstretched arm, with great terror and with signs and wonders. He brought us to this place and has given us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. And now behold, I have brought the first fruits of the land which you, O Lord, have given me. Then you shall set it before the Lord your God and worship before the Lord your God. So you shall rejoice in every good thing which the Lord your God has given to you in your house, you and the Levite and the stranger who is among you. When you have finished laying aside all the tithe of your increase in the third year, the year of tithing, and have given it to the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, so that they may eat within your gates and be filled, then you shall say before the Lord your God, I have removed the holy tithe from my house, and also have given them to the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, according to all your commandments which you have commanded me. I have not transgressed your commandments, nor have I forgotten them. I have not eaten any of it when in mourning, nor have I removed any of it for an unclean use, nor given any of it for the dead. I have obeyed the voice of the Lord my God, and have done according to all that you have commanded me. Look down from your holy habitation from heaven, and bless your people Israel and the land which you have given us. just as you swore to our fathers, a land flowing with milk and honey. This day the Lord your God commands you to observe these statutes and judgments. Therefore you shall be careful to observe them with all your heart and with all your soul. Today you have proclaimed the Lord to be your God, and that you will walk in his ways and keep his statutes, his judgments, and his commandments and his judgments, and that you will obey his voice. And today the Lord has proclaimed you to be his special people, just as he promised you that you should keep all his commandments, and that he will set you high above all nations which he has made, in praise and name and in honor, and that you may be a holy people to the Lord your God, just as he has spoken. Let me point out at the beginning that there aren't very many references at all on the board today, but the first string of references is to other passages in the Old Testament and one in the New Testament where there are similar historical surveys given as what we'll be discussing in this chapter. Okay, so I'd like to look at this chapter section by section, but I want to start by summarizing a little bit of what's going on here. As I mentioned already, this is the conclusion of the long middle section of the book of Deuteronomy, chapters 5 or 6, depending on how you count, through chapter 26, in which the law is given and explained. And that careful exposition is what we've been dwelling on in recent weeks. This chapter is technically part of that exposition, but is also a very helpful transition to the next section, as well as a way of drawing us back to what we saw in the very beginning. So let me just mention both of those aspects. First of all, the opening sections of Deuteronomy, the opening chapters of Deuteronomy, chapters 1 through 4, say, form a historical prologue. We looked at it, it wasn't that long ago, but we did look at it, and you can see the connection in chapter 26 with that historical prologue. They're really rehearsing the things that they had seen already, God's mercy to them. And as one commentator says, you know, they're really saying their amen to that. This is their affirmation that God indeed has been good to them. This chapter also looks forward to the last part of Deuteronomy in which they ratify or renew the covenant. And you can see that especially at the end of the chapter where they renew the heart of the covenant, which is that they profess God to be their God and he has taken them to be his people. So then the next chapter, for example, talks about the enforcement of the covenant in terms of the curses that come on those who violate the covenant. So we're going to take a break before we get to that. But that's how this chapter, it really helps us to understand a lot of where we've been as well as what's still to come in Deuteronomy. But secondly, the specific topic of this chapter is the law of the first fruits and of tithing. Now, both the discussion of first fruits and of tithing came up earlier in the book of Deuteronomy. So the first fruits are connected with many of the major festivals. It's not clear exactly here whether there's a specific festival in mind in which this profession would be made, but let me just remind you that the basic idea both of the first fruits and of the tithing is that God is the landowner. Okay, so it's the basic understanding is that because God owns the land, because God has given them the land, all the crops that they are able to grow, and in fact, everything they have comes from God. So that's the basic assumption. Even when we give to God, and the pastor reminds us of that, when we give to God, it is that all that we have comes from God. And God worked it into the mind of the Israelites by this giving of the first fruits, the first part of the crop they got. Part of that was supposed to go to God, to say really the whole thing is God's, and to say that all of their wealth came from God, and all that they had. Now, let me just mention in connection with that the way this fits into the exposition of the Ten Commandments. You may remember, if you've been with us for a while, that I've tried to tie in the different chapters of Deuteronomy with the Ten Commandments, and we were making the case for a while that there seemed to be a close connection with the order. I think you can make a case that that tithing and giving of your first fruits is a fulfillment of the Tenth Commandment. Thou shalt not covet, because the opposite of being covetousness is to realize that you can be content with what God has given you, and you can share with others. That's mentioned here, with the poor and the needy, but also to give to God and for the work of God. So this chapter, I think, does fit in with the conclusion of that discussion and the way the Ten Commandments are explained in the book of Deuteronomy. I haven't said anything in the last couple of weeks about the other connections, because I found them, frankly, rather tenuous. I mean, the different commentators divide up the previous chapters differently, but basically the question of how the not bearing false witness is connected with the preceding chapters and coveting is a little bit tricky in my mind, so I didn't really bring that up. It might be something fruitful for further discussion. Okay, so that's the second part of my introduction, then, is just to say, remind us what the law of the first fruits and tithing are about. The third thing is that what's unique here, and we'll expand on this as we look at each section, is that God provides words for this fellow to say. This is a farmer, so we'll refer to him as the farmer. So the farmer comes in the first part to the central place of worship, ultimately to Jerusalem. He brings his first fruits, and God has prepared a little speech for him to give. God gives him the words of the speech, but that's really a unique and a striking feature of this. It's really a profession of faith that he gives. There's a brief statement in verse 3, but especially verses 5 through 10. My father was a Syrian about to perish. The New King James has it. And then after that first section comes the second section, in which he basically testifies of his faithfulness, verses 13 through 15. And this is important because it's easy for giving to be just an empty ritual. Okay, so brought my check to church, going to put it in the basket. You know, here they had something else to put in the basket, but they had the first fruits. But to avoid that being an empty ritual, God gave them words to repeat. And the point wasn't just to repeat the words, but to think about the significance of it. And that's the beautiful thing. It's really a very wonderful chapter in many ways to help us think about all that we've been looking at in Deuteronomy, and I'll try to come back to that. But especially to think about the way in which we come before God in worship and acknowledge that everything belongs to Him. And He gives us words to speak. He gave the farmer here words to speak about that. And we're going to look at the words, but I thought it was worth noting that up front. Okay, so that's sort of an introduction. I wanted to orient us to what was going on in the chapter before we launched into the specific parts. But any comments or questions so far? Yes, Vicki.
It says for the farmer, this was part of his worship at the tabernacle?
Yes.
Are you familiar with some churches are hesitant now or questioning why we have offering during church service?
Yeah, I thought about that in connection with this. I think it is a good point. There's a historical background to that point, and maybe we don't need to discuss it here, but it is clear here that there's more to it than just a ritual aspect. There's a God provides a way for the person to meditate on the spiritual significance of the giving, which is important. Okay. Oh, Dan. Yes.
I guess this puts a kibosh on the idea of automatic withdrawal.
Well, if when you click the button, it also played the little confession for you or something, maybe that would be okay.
Email me a prayer receipt.
As long as it says that it's putting it in the basket.
Okay. Right, so let's look at each of these sections. There are three of them. They get the first one is the longest, verses 1 through 11, which is where the farmer is to come before God with his offering. So notice the context in verse 1. It is after they have entered the land, and even there is an emphasis on God's goodness to them. The land the Lord your God has given you as an inheritance, and you possess, and you dwell in it. So the idea is that you're going to be settled in the land long enough to have produced some crops, and this is what's supposed to happen after you are in that situation. What they're supposed to do is to go to the central place of worship. That's mentioned in verse 2. We discussed that way back in Deuteronomy 12, but God said he would appoint a central place. Ultimately, it was in Jerusalem, in which they were to worship. And God says you're supposed to go to that central place. You're supposed to go before the priest who is there then and present the first fruits. And then, as I said, you're supposed to make this declaration. And what's striking about the declaration, there's a brief declaration in verse 3, and then it's filled out more in verses 5 and following. And what's striking about it is the long history involved. So he starts out in verse 5, he's supposed to say, "My father was a Syrian about to perish." Now this is almost certainly referring to Jacob, who was, of course, not the immediate father of any of these people, but he was the father of the nation of Israel. Israel was Jacob's other name, right? And so it's probably referring to Jacob. And the first thing that's striking about this is that Jacob lived 500 years or more before they said this. So they're going way back in their history. They're not looking at recent history, although that does come in. They go way back to the working of God in history, and I want to come back to that in terms of the application to us, because we're not used to thinking in those terms. I mean, you know, what a joke that I can hardly remember what it was that Justin Bieber tweeted this week. Is that the right way to pronounce his name? I mean, wasn't he busted in Sweden for marijuana or something? Anyway, you know, I mean, we don't have that same sort of orientation. But they had this tremendous orientation given by God. They're supposed to look back over 500 years and think about what God had done for them. Now, how does that work out? Well, first of all, there's a reference to Jacob as a Syrian. Some translations have it as an Aramean. He lived in a region which is now part of the country of Syria. It's probably more accurate to say he was an Aramean. Why is he referred to that way? Well, remember, his mother came from that region, and he went there to get married. In fact, he got two wives there, and 11 of his 12 sons were born there. So although he wasn't, you might say, technically an Aramean in the sense that he wasn't born there, much of his working career was there, 20 years working there. Much of his family was from there. And that identification serves a further purpose in the context as well. It also says about him in the New King James that he was about to perish. And I think the ESV says he was wandering. It's easier to say he was a wandering Aramean, so that's the way I'll refer to him. The word there isn't frequently used in the Old Testament, but it is. It does have the sense of someone who's in a desperate condition. So that would certainly apply to Jacob. Jacob was in Syria, in Aramea with his father-in-law, but he didn't leave on the best of terms, right? He had to flee from his father-in-law. And so some people have noted the connection actually in other extra-biblical literature with the idea of refugees, like political refugees. And so it gives you the sense that when they refer to their father, Jacob, as a wandering Aramean, this is a guy whose life was lived on the edge. Okay, he was in a fragile and dangerous condition. He wasn't someone who had a nice settled estate and everything was just fine. This was someone who lived an unsettled life, who had to flee from Laban and flee into the arms of his hostile brother Esau. Okay, so that gives you the sense then of the transitory nature of the sort of transient, you might say, that their father was. And even there, after he had escaped from Laban, what does it say? Well, he went down to Egypt, and that was because of the famine in the land. So there again, you get the sense that here's our ancestor. He didn't have a nice, quiet, settled condition. He was out of the frying pan and into the fire, that sort of thing. He had to flee from Laban, but then they all had to go down to Egypt. And when they went down to Egypt, they were only few in number. And what happened to them in Egypt? Well, they were mistreated. They were oppressed by the Egyptians. They were in a terrible condition. And then the confession points out that although that was the case, yet God multiplied them. It says they became a nation, great, mighty, and populous. And especially that God heard their cry when they were oppressed by the Egyptians and delivered them and brought them out with great power and saved them. As I said, this sort of history we're used to. I'm going over it fairly quickly. It's repeated early in the book of Deuteronomy, and especially the deliverance then that followed through the wilderness. But it's repeated here for a specific purpose because it's connected with the last part of the confession in verses 9 and 10, where he says, "And God brought us to the place where we are now." Okay, so in other words, they're not in this promised land just like they've always been. You know, this is something that we always had back from our fathers. No, this is a remarkable thing because they had no hope. The best they could look at in their far ancestor was a refugee. And when they fled to Egypt, it only got worse. And yet, now remarkably, here they are in the land that God has promised to bless them as a land flowing with milk and honey. And that's why he says in verse 10, "And now behold, I have brought the first fruits of the land which you, O Lord, have given me." Of course, that's the emphasis of the whole thing. God gave it to them not just that the crops grew that year, but that they would have had nothing unless God had delivered this wandering Aramean and brought them through the wilderness and into the promised land. It is really worthwhile to reflect on what this would have meant to them. And as I said, I want to step back toward the end and look at what it would mean to us. But first of all, it underlines the fact that all of the wealth that they had came from God. This is a point that we made in Deuteronomy chapter 8. And it's something that it's very easy for prosperous Americans to forget. So I will make a little application there. It's very easy for us to think, well, you know, everything's fine, I'm earning money, and, you know, I'm getting along just fine. But in fact, what God said in Deuteronomy 8 is really what's being said here again, and that is, you know, it's so easy for you to forget how much you depend on God. And if God didn't sustain you, if God didn't give you the rain, if God didn't make the crops to grow, if God didn't give you the health so that you could eat your food, you'd be nothing. And that's you might say, the upfront application of this. When they had a good crop, they were supposed to remember that everything they had came from God. And God put that as something that they would do regularly, year by year. Every time they had a crop, God said to them, "Don't be proud. You depend completely on me." But it has a deeper application than only our material blessings, although usually that's the way God gets at us is through our material blessings because we tend to trust in them. And that is, you can see here again and again, the close connection between the blessing of the land and all of God's promises. The land was part of the promise that God had given to Abraham. And in connection with that promise, in fulfillment of that promise, he gave them the land. But this chapter emphasizes the greater aspects of that and how God chose them out as a people. That'll become clearer in the last part of the chapter. God redeemed them to himself, and that's clear in the deliverance from Egypt. It wasn't because of their own greatness, and that's been emphasized earlier in Deuteronomy, right? They were few in number, okay? So if God had been surveying all the peoples of the earth and said, you know, which one of the ones do I think would be best to bless? I think he would have overlooked those, you know, stragglers down in Egypt. They were an oppressed minority. They didn't have a lot of promise. But God had promised to bless them. And that's the whole point of this. So it is to exalt God on the one hand and to praise him for his mercy. And on the other hand, it is to keep them from being proud, not only of their ability to earn wealth, but just of themselves as a people. After all, if you believe that God has blessed your nation, then the temptation is to say, well, that's because we must be pretty good. Now, God keeps hammering in their head that that's not the case. He doesn't bless them because they're righteous. He doesn't bless them because they're numerous. But here, it's especially striking the way he does it, because he says, now, I want you to think about your great ancestor, you know. In the West, people like to say, I'm descended from Charlemagne or someone like that. You know, I have a really great heritage and I can brag about it. So here God says, I want you to think back about your great heritage, your great-great-great-grandfather. He was a refugee. Now, isn't that something to be proud of, in effect? It is to lower man in his own estimation and to realize the utter need and the utter devastation that they were in and the mercy of God in bringing them out of it. We need to hear that all the time, because so often we like to think of ourselves as deserving of God's mercy, as great in ourselves. But, just think back about what your father was and how he worshipped stones, crawling around in the mud, and how empty life was before God showed mercy. I'm going to try to come back to that in terms of thinking about our own history. But this is a really remarkable passage from that point of view, and that God says, recite your history, but your history is not for your glory. Your history is really humiliating from one point of view, because it shows how lowly you were, and instead exalts the mercy of God. Okay, that was a longer section. I'm going to promise to spend... I don't know, I keep my promises to spend less on the other sections. Any comments or questions so far? Didn't insult anyone's parentage or anything like that. Yes, Dan.
I'm just trying to make the interaction, so that's fine.
Yeah, that's fine.
But it'd be pretty, we kind of gloss over it sometimes, but the farmer would be, they'd be very likely to say, well, I worked every day, sun up to sun down, and I put the right fertilizer down, and I've been studying what's best about the fields. I mean, this crop was, I read Proverbs, talks about the diligent man.
Right.
I studied for the exams all year long. I did the homework. I did this. I returned all my emails, all these things we do. So, really, I look at this mighty Babylon I've built, because really it was all my diligence that
right.
was, which is true, but in a sense that God blesses that. But it's very easy to just kind of think, well, I did all these things, and so I've really done a good job here.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's a great temptation, and God. It's really striking that God put this little ritual in place exactly to counteract that tendency. And He gave them words to say, because otherwise they'd probably say that sort of thing. Well, you'll notice, God, that my basket is bigger than anyone else's here, and that sort of thing. Yeah, good. Okay, let's look at the next section, which is verses 12 through 15. Here, the whole chapter is, you might say, conceptually connected. That is, the ideas are quite similar. It's not clear that verses 12 through 15 take place at the same time. There's a specific mention here of the tithe of the third year. Okay, so we did talk about this. This was back in chapter 14 of Deuteronomy. Don't know how many weeks ago that was, but I remember there was a structure to their system of time, so that every 7 years there was a sabbatical year, and every third year within that 7 year period was a special tithe, which was to be given to the needy. Okay, so it's mentioned specifically here in verse 12, given to the Levite, so that was the religious leader who ministered among them, and the stranger and the fatherless and the widow. So that tithe was actually not presented at the central sanctuary, but at the local place, in the closest town. And that's the emphasis here. And that emphasis is actually already in verse 11 of the preceding section. That is, that the tithe is to be a way of blessing others as well, especially the needy. And that's a point that we've seen again and again in Deuteronomy. Said this was a good review chapter. After all, final exams are this week, so we need to review some. No, I did not plan it that way. Okay, so not intending for the OSU students to squirm in their seats or something like that. There's no final on Deuteronomy this week. But it is an occasion for us to remember how much the book emphasizes the need to show mercy to the defenseless, to the needy, to provide for them, and also to care for the one who ministers the word to us. The Levite had that function. So that's the, you might say, the context immediately of verses 12 through 15. But again, God provides something for the person to say in presenting this this tithe. The statement has specific connection to the presentation of the tithe. So it says, I have given it to the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow. So it says, I've done with my tithe what I'm supposed to do. and I haven't eaten any of it in mourning. So there were ways in which they could become unclean in the ceremonial system of the Old Testament, and there are also pagan practices in which they might be tempted to be ensnared. I don't really want to get into the details of it, but basically this section is a profession of faithfulness, saying, Lord, I have resolved to walk in your ways. And the presentation of the tithe is the occasion for that, and so the specific faithfulness is in connection with the use of the tithe, which it's always good for us to think about how we use our money. But the larger application has to do with the way in which they confess that they belong to God and therefore will walk before him. And it concludes with a prayer in verse 15, which is a very beautiful prayer. Look down from your holy habitation from heaven and bless your people Israel in the land which you have given us, just as you swore to our fathers, a land flowing with milk and honey. Now, the specific promise that's referred to has to do with the specific Old Testament situation in which their abiding in the land was connected with their faithfulness. And, you know, those who lived around the time of Jeremiah saw the results of the long-term idolatry and disobedience to God, which was that they were expelled from the land. So that's the specific connection here. But it is a reminder for us in all of our prayers not to be so individually focused. It's good for us to pray for, to ask prayer for our own concerns. But here specifically, the address toward God is not for me, it's for your people, Israel. It's a public-spirited or public-minded kind of prayer, which is a good reminder to us that our orientation should be broader than ourselves and our own immediate concerns, to think about the blessing of God on his own people. And that is a good lesson to draw from this. Let me just mention that some people have seen a connection between this and the Pharisee and the publican, the story that Jesus tells, and the fact that this guy professes his obedience to the law could be twisted by the Pharisee into a sort of self-righteousness, but only if the Pharisee failed to read the whole chapter, which is a complete emphasis on God's righteousness and God's mercy to us and not our own righteousness. Let's just quickly then go to the last section, verses 16 through 19, which is really a sort of a transition to the chapters that follow in terms of the ratification or renewal of the covenant. And here they're not words that they're supposed to speak, but it says what they have said already. There is a mutual declaration of allegiance that's given here. Allegiance may not be the right word on God's part, but what it says in verse 17 is, today you have proclaimed the Lord to be your God. So they stand before God, they worship God. I omitted that part in the discussion of the first section, but they were, after presenting the tithe, they were to worship God and to rejoice in the goodness of God to them. And that's the basic aspect of worship, is to proclaim the Lord to be our God. And what's striking about this is that this is reciprocated. That is, in verse 18 it says, today the Lord has proclaimed you to be his special people. So that's the way the covenant functions. The covenant is a mutual relationship. We profess God to be our God, and God, amazingly, professes us to be his people. And in fact, it uses the word here, his special people or his treasured people. Again, this is a review from Deuteronomy. This phrase came up especially earlier in the book, where God says that he had set them apart from all the peoples of the earth to be his treasured possession. And the New Testament takes that up and applies it to believers, and specifically to the gathering in of the Gentiles. But that's really the heart of the covenant relationship. I mean, you could spend a long time talking about covenant theology and what the book of Deuteronomy is about, but at heart it is that we take God to be our God, and he takes us to be his people. It's like a marriage bond. There's a mutual pledge of love and faithfulness. And we, of course, as creatures, have an obligation to profess God to be our God, but it's God's special mercy and kindness that he takes us to be his own, and he draws us to himself. Now that that is worked out then in the way they give themselves wholly over to God. So that's the way you should understand in verse 16 that God commands you to observe these statutes and judgments, and you shall be careful to observe them with all your heart and with all your soul. That wholehearted commitment that's called for there flows out of the fact that we profess the Lord to be our God. It's a natural consequence of giving yourself over to another that you will hear what the other has to say to you. And in this case, it's not on equal footing. You take God to be your God, and therefore you will listen to his commandments. But that phrase, you know, all your heart and all your soul, should remind us of, again, Deuteronomy 6, for example, that the greatest commandment, as Jesus referred to it, was to love the Lord our God with all our heart and with all our soul. And I want to emphasize this point because we've just gone through several weeks of looking at very specific commandments from the case law. Some of them we don't normally talk about in public, and I won't repeat them this week. I mean, there are lots of details, and it's easy to get lost in all of that and to say, you know, well, it's just all this mass of details, and it doesn't really matter. But the point of all of the commandments is that the person who loves God will listen to what God says and will say, now, how am I supposed to love my neighbor in this practical situation? How is that going to work out? We'll say, well, if I'm going to have people on my rooftop, I better put a fence around it so they don't fall off. Okay? I mean, that's a practical application of loving God. And that's what the entire previous discussion in Deuteronomy is really about. It's about how can I love God and how can I love my neighbor? And God says, well, let me spell it out the way it looked in their situation. Okay? Now, I don't have people walking on my roof normally. I mean, personally. So I don't do that. But there are other ways in which I can make sure that people don't injure themselves on my property. There are other ways in which I can try to work out the law. And I think it's really important for us to remember verse 16 at the end of that study, because the whole thing is that God wants our wholehearted commitment. And, okay, it's easy to get bogged down sometimes. It's hard to understand some of the law. But the whole orientation of the heart should be to walk before God and do that in faithfulness. And it's really striking because it's spelled out further in the last part that God's special care for you is to the end that you will be high above all the nations which he has made. That this instruction that God had given them and the special place that he had given them to worship him was intended to draw all the nations in to see the wisdom of God and the mercy of God. I mean, not to that they were the great attraction there, but to see the great power that God had shown there. And he therefore emphasizes his election, his choosing of the nation, by proclaiming them as his special people. But that election has a particular end, a purpose, which is at the end of verse 19, that they would be a holy people to the Lord your God, just as he has spoken, which underlines, it's just another way of saying that they're consecrated to God and they will therefore love him with all of their hearts. Now, it really is a remarkable conclusion to that section of Deuteronomy, considering what we've been talking about in previous weeks and all the sort of fine detail that God enables them to step back and say, you know, what's really going on is that I have loved you, I've taken you out of utter destitution and desolation, and I've drawn you to myself, and I'm calling you to walk before me as someone who's received that kind of love and mercy. That's really what the heart of the law is about. It's about someone who's received that mercy and is to walk in that mercy that's been received. I still want to think a little bit about us and our own sort of histories, but let me pause there and see if you have any comments or questions on this chapter so far. Vicki?
Because our relationship with Christ is pictured often as a marriage, that's why that institution should be so particular.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, that's another way to look at all of the discussion about marital relationships and sexual relationships, some of which is pretty embarrassing in Deuteronomy. It is there to guard, for one thing, marriage as a picture of the relationship of Christ in the church. Good. Okay, well, I want to think a little bit about this this profession, and especially the idea that they would be driven to look back at where they had been as part of their worship. That was what God gave them to do as they came before Him. So I started to think about, you know, what would you say is your own history? And this is an important question, because what we think of as our history is closely connected with our identity. So when someone asked a Jew what made him a Jew, one thing he might start with is, well, my father was a wandering Aramean. In fact, that's part of the Passover ritual still among Jews, is a recitation of this statement from Deuteronomy. That's part of their identity. When they think about themselves and who they are, they go back to their history. They don't think about tweets and that sort of thing, at least not immediately. They think about their history and how God brought them to where they are. So how will we think about ourselves? Well, one way in which I thought we could get started with that is by turning to Ephesians chapter 2. It's actually a very interesting question to think about, and I'm sure that others can come up with other ways of answering the question. But as I thought about it, I thought one way that would be fruitful, especially because we're predominantly, exclusively Gentile, ethnically, that it would be helpful for us to think about how we could say a parallel statement about our own background. And Paul does that for us in Ephesians 2, starting in verse 11. He says, "Therefore remember that you, once Gentiles in the flesh, who are called uncircumcision by what is called the circumcision made in the flesh by hands, that at that time you were without Christ, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel and strangers from the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world." Okay, so that could be the first part of our statement. So who were we? Well, our parents were idolaters. Our parents had no hope. They were completely cut off from the revelation of salvation, which was given to the nation of Israel. They were atheists in the sense that they had no God because they didn't have the true God. Now, they may have invented a lot of idols, and those idols couldn't speak or anything like that, but that's our heritage. Okay, so if you want to sort of puff yourself up, you can say, well, we used to bow down before statues. That's our heritage. But Paul gives us more than that, so otherwise it'd be kind of depressing. He says, "But now in Christ Jesus, you who once were far off have been brought near by the blood of Christ." And I'm going to skip over a lot of it, but let me just notice also verse 19. "Now therefore you are no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God." So isn't that a remarkable confession then that we can have? That if we think in the bigger term, if we think back maybe thousands of years, we can say, you know, until the work of Christ came, we had no hope, speaking as those who were outside the covenant people. We were cut off. We were without God. And yet Christ in His mercy brought us near, and He showed us that kindness. And what's striking about verse 19, and the reason I want to read it, is that it says, in effect, that we're now adopted into the family of God. So that means that we can actually recite what they recited in Deuteronomy 26. We can say now, my father was a wandering Aramean, because I've been adopted into that family. And that history of the Old Testament becomes our history. So that's how Paul can say when he writes to the Corinthians, our fathers passed through the sea. And you say, sorry, my fathers, you know, they weren't anywhere near Egypt as far as I know, but Paul ties us into that history. And I want to emphasize that, especially because it's, in our day, I think there's a real sense, especially among younger people, of a lack of being rooted in anything, a lack of sense of a community, a lack of historical belonging. And we, in the Christian faith, and I would say specifically in the way we worship, have a great sense of orientation to history, because you notice in that list of historical recitations are several psalms. When we sing the psalms, we're saying, this is my history too. This is the way God has worked in history to bring his people to where they are. And the Psalms sing of the gathering in of the Gentiles as well. And specifically, since we have the Lord's Supper today, we also, in our gathering for worship, also profess the faith that we read about in Deuteronomy 26. We engage ourselves to belong to God, and we renew our covenant with God, as well as our love for each other. So the way our worship is set up is intended to not to cut us off from that history, but to allow us to say, indeed, my father was a wandering Aramean, or, you know, at one time I was called uncircumcision because I was cut off from hope, and yet God in his mercy has redeemed me in Christ. This chapter turned out to be a lot more interesting than I thought it would be. I hope you get some sense of the value of it. Any comments or questions? Deuteronomy 26? Yes, John. History graduate student, so there we go. This was for you.
I was just thinking that was a great point of being there, because I was thinking the same as you were going there, that this isn't a knock on personal testimonies or anything. A lot of times you ask people, well, what's your testimony? And so, you know, it's very like, me, I was born this way.
Right.
And, you know, him and I did this, and I did this. And, like, I was thinking, you know, we kind of individualize, especially in our society, it's so individual driven, you know,
right,
it's me, yeah, you know? And that's why you have all these people that don't come to church and they're not part of the community, they don't understand the greater context.
Yeah,
what has Christ done, you know?
Right. Yeah, I actually thought about that too. I have the privilege of being an elder, so I hear professions of faith, and sometimes you hear people who grew up in a Christian home and they have a testimony of a heritage like that. Sometimes they don't. I don't really expect them to say, you know, here's my profession, my father was a wandering Aramean, but you know, in the bigger context, we should think in those terms, exactly what you said. We should realize that we're part of a much bigger story that God has graciously brought us into. And you know, I'm a mathematician, I don't like to talk about stories and that kind of thing, but it is true that the Bible really is oriented that way. It's in the flow of history that God brought about the redemption. And you know, Romans is a great for doctrine, but it's rooted in a historical thing. In fact, you know, Paul could have said, oh, here's your story, you're a son of Adam, which is a great privilege, but also, you know, here is the rebel who ruined all of creation, and that's my father.
And I think a lot of people think I don't think they like hearing something like, maybe they're just not going to be that great, like Martin Luther or something.
Oh, uh-huh.
You're just...
Right.
Yeah, because they don't look at it in the grand scheme of redemptive history. They're just like, how am I going to make a name for myself?
You know? Huh. And I hadn't thought about that. That's good. Yeah.
It's that, you know, people don't like to be said, well, you might just be a stepping stone.
Right. Into history. You might just be that farmer, but God put his name on you, and you know, what greater privilege is there than that, that you can serve him? Yeah. Randy?
Well, I think that emphasis they put on 1 Corinthians 10, that, you know, our fathers, you know, that, yeah.
Right.
And then, you know, in Romans 4, he says Abraham is the father of us all.
Right.
And then Galatians 3:29, if you were Christ, you are Abraham's offspring, heirs according to promise. And so, you know, a lot of Christians today will say, well, all I care is that I'm a part of Christ. I don't care that I'm really a part of Abraham's offspring. And they don't understand the covenantal meaning,
right,
of how God has redemptively worked throughout history.
Right. It really does enrich the way we think about our salvation to remember that. Wow, you guys are interested in this. Yes, Dan.
You mentioned being rooted too. It's kind of already been said, but there's a, especially, I don't know about other cultures around the world, but certainly in our culture, everything's so, like John was saying, so individualistic. You know, we don't believe in a king. You don't become king because of what family you were born into. Anybody can be president. And if you don't like this church, don't worry about solving the problem. Just go find another church. And if you don't like this marriage, well, try for a little while, but then if it just doesn't work out, things come to an end, go find another marriage. And, you know, we're so transient, you don't like this job, just go find another job. Not that I'm saying any of those things. don't happen, or that it's bad to go find a new job. But there's just not much of a sense of commitment, really. To, in a lot of people, I think there's not really a deep sense of commitment to much. So this seems to really run counter to that, the notion of covenant. He's all talking about covenant.
Uh-huh. Right.
The idea of covenant. It's a lot deeper.
Good. Right. Let's close in prayer.